Yeah, we did rock, paper, scissors, and I lost, so I get to go first. I have a set of prepared remarks that, well, I prepared, but I'm going to use the power of the podium quickly to kind of contextualize those with regard to what came on our discussions earlier today. I like to do a little exercise with my students at SFU that tries to convince them that they are scientists and researchers. And I talk a little bit about the way we interact with our world, and that the way we interact with our world is based on observation. So we are constantly observing what is going on around us, whether it's raining, whether it's sunny, the smiles of people that we're talking with, or the frowns, or whatever it happens to be. And we're developing hypotheses about what that means to us and in our current situation. We then test those hypotheses to see if we're right. For instance, this morning I woke up, it's raining, and so I hypothesized that it was going to take me forever to drive from Surrey to get here. So I decided that I was going to take the SkyTrain. And I test that by taking the SkyTrain, and it takes me much less time to get here. So I'm experimenting, I'm observing, I'm testing hypotheses, I'm revising these, and then testing them again. All this to say that we interact with our world in a scientific manner. And when we decide, when we start saying that we don't, that we aren't scientists, that we aren't researchers, we kind of take a lot of the intentionality behind why we do what we do away. It's disempowering, in effect, from my perspective. And I say this to lead into the way we interact as educators with data, whatever that data may happen to be. Whether it's an FSA, whether it's observing what's going on in our classroom, whether it's talking to other teachers, all of this is data that we use that influences our practice. It's sort of like the parable of the blind man and the elephant, where everybody is touching the elephant in a different part, and they're trying to figure out what the whole is. Okay, and each person feels one part of it and thinks it's something different. One has the trunk and thinks it's a snake. One has a leg and thinks it's a column. Whatever it happens to be, they all have an incomplete picture of what the whole is. And so when we talk about data and education, I argue that we should be looking at all the data we can get to try to get a big picture of what is actually happening in schools. Inherent, though, in that is that we can't reject the trunk because we don't like the way it feels. We still need to know what role it plays in the broader picture. And so when we talk about things like the FSA, we may not like what it tells us, and we may not like the way it is used, but it still gives us information, and that information is not in and of itself something that is bad or wrong. It's the application of that information that we should be objecting to. So all that said, that sets the context for my more prepared remarks, which are going to focus on accountability and how we use data or misuse data within an accountability framework, and how that begins to corrupt the process. In preparing for this conversation, like many people, I went to Google, and I figured, okay, well, let's see what Google has to say about accountability. So I typed in education and accountability, and I got about 2.1 million hits. Okay. Then I typed in student accountability, and I got 900,000 returns, so that's getting better. And then I typed in teacher accountability and got down to 400,000, so we're getting manageable here. But then I got crazy and I said, what happens if I just type in the word accountability? I got 78 million returns. The seventh one on the list was the BC Ministry of Education. Okay. So clearly, accountability is a key issue in BC today. But if we're going to talk about accountability, we have to understand what we mean by accountability systems. Accountability systems generally have three components: actors within the system who are held accountable, data gathering systems on which we can make judgments, and the mechanisms to leverage change. And these are frequently in the form of sanctions or rewards. In the current usage, the concept of accountability implies this hierarchical set of relationships. Some actors held accountable for their behavior or for producing some action by another authority. At its most basic, the actor and an authority can be the same. I hold myself accountable for my behaviors. In education, though, it's generally hierarchical, where we hold our students accountable for their behaviors, and the ministry or the administration holds us accountable for our actions. In the BC context, the second component around data analysis or data gathering is based primarily on standardized provincial assessments of academic achievement. Again, the FSAs for reading, writing, and numeracy at the elementary level, and language arts, science, math, and social studies at the secondary level. These accountability mechanisms include sanctioning, such as withholding of a diploma or rewards that would include things like post-secondary scholarships. For schools and educators, the mechanisms are less direct, but include shaming through public reporting of data by the ministry or organizations like the Fraser Institute, regular review and revision of accountability contracts, and student mobility due to parent choice. Accountability systems like the one in BC are relatively easy to understand, simple to implement, and unfortunately, such a simple approach to accountability ignores the complexity involved in education. While the data-driven systems hold the potential to support positive change, as the stakes for students and educators are increased, or the focus of education outcome narrows, in BC's case to literacy and numeracy, corruption of the system becomes much more likely. We see a fairly consistent progression based on the concept of data-driven decision-making. It begins with the move to define standards, create assessments so that we can gather data around those standards, and then examine system performance, and target change efforts based on the needs identified by the data. I'm going to go away from my remarks again because there's another comment I wanted to make on this whole process of gathering data. And that is, when we define the standards that we think are important for literacy or numeracy or English, as a former teacher of English, we can only define a specific standard, a specific subset of the entire domain. So as much as we may feel like what we do is a mile wide and an inch deep, that's just a sample of the real domain, which is 100 miles wide, okay? Then when we take an assessment, which at best can only sample part of the standards, because otherwise we would be testing for days and days and days, we're really talking about a sample of what is. And so, again, we're just looking at one small piece of the larger picture. Our focus needs to be on helping people understand that, and that if we, and I wish I had a graphic that I could use to support this, where you take a picture and you just take one little piece of that, and then you take a sub-picture of that and ask people to identify what they're looking at. There's no way you can do it. And so that illustrates some of the problems with using standardized tests as an accountability mechanism. The data is still accurate. We just need to make sure it's used as one part of a broader picture. Okay, so back to the more prepared remarks. The idea of data-driven decision-making can give us data on which we can make evidence to guide change. And that's a hopeful thing. The problem comes when we begin to start adding accountability mechanisms and using the data gathering to actually change behaviors rather than guide change. If I try to figure out where I should fit this back in. I think one of the main challenges that educators and policymakers face in BC is the general expansion of high stakes to leverage the system's change. Okay? Policymakers feel like if they want to make you change, they have to do it by making something so unpleasant or so wonderfully pleasant through rewards that you will change your behaviors, rather than saying what is the vision that we all want to achieve and motivating change from within. So the fight that you and policymakers interested in this face is trying to keep the high stakes siren from singing, and maintain your focus on the broader purposes of education. There are ways that you can do this. Before I get there, though, I want to highlight two more reasons that I think the high-stakes systems seem to develop. First, they're based on outdated theories of individual and organizational behavior. Again, that behaviorist mechanism of stimulus and response. The second reason is a limited capacity to monitor the multiple purposes and outcomes sought by educational systems. So again, we've developed these proxy measures to simplify the approach. So the behavioral approach to organizational development and the narrowing of focus to these single measures results in an accountability system that has four important, albeit flawed, assumptions. First, academic achievement should be the primary outcome of education. Second, our data gathering systems can adequately measure those outcomes. Third, that the system is adequately funded and resourced so that every student can reach the defined learning outcomes. And fourth, that increasing achievement is in many instances simply a matter of motivation. Unfortunately, there are problems with each of these basic assumptions. While academic achievement is important, schools serve critical economic, social, personal, and societal purposes, and we've talked about those today. By focusing narrowly on specific assessment scores and grades, these broader purposes are lost. Data gathering systems based on standardized assessments exacerbate this problem by narrowing the examination to only a part of the knowledge that, first of all, that pencil and paper tests can actually assess, and then ignoring the broader set of data on which to make judgments. While the funding system in BC is relatively fair, research suggests that schools across the province have significantly varying access to resources and are forced to rely on hundreds of millions of dollars in private fundraising. Additionally, the consistent link between poverty and achievement suggests that in many areas, significant gaps in capacity exist. Research looking at overcoming the effects of poverty suggests that per pupil spending should be as much as 100% more for low SES students. Finally, using rewards, sanctions, and shaming to leverage motivational change is dangerous, particularly once the focus shifts from changing what schools do to focusing on solely the outcomes, irrespective of the methods used to get there. This last point is particularly important to highlight because it creates a system focused on the ends rather than the means. In other words, it doesn't matter how we get these high scores, it just matters that we do. While the hope is that achievement will be improved through sound teaching methods, focused study, access to better learning resources, higher academic achievement, averages can also be achieved by excluding or pushing out low-achieving students, teaching to the test, narrowing the curriculum to assess subjects, etc. It's important to note that these responses may happen irrespective of the measures used, be it a high-stakes test, graduation rate, attendance. If we use a single standard like this, we're going to build incentives to corrupt the system. As the stakes in such accountability systems are increased and legislation limits the conditions that educators do control, teachers are left to change the practices along a very narrow band of practice. You don't have control over funding and allocation of classroom resources. You don't have control of curriculum or textbooks or provision of supplemental services like libraries, cafeterias, or transportation. So instead, teachers are left to rely on the things that they can control, such as pedagogical instructional change or readjusting instructional resource allocations. These changes can include narrowing the curriculum, teaching to the test, or teaching in other educationally unsound methods that are designed to get short-term gains. A recent survey of U.S. teachers found that 75% thought that testing programs had led teachers in their schools to teach in educationally unsound ways. A survey of teachers in Ontario came to a similar conclusion, finding that respondents did not trust the province's accountability system and the policies of the 90s had negatively affected the motivation of educators. So if the current accountability mechanisms are likely to be ineffective at improving education systems, are there other options? Specific examples can be found in the fields of health and economics, and I'll just highlight these two. There are dozens of other examples, but I'll throw these out for your consideration. The field of health and education are closely related. We know that healthy children learn better, and that better educated people tend to be more healthy. Because of this cyclical relationship, educators and public health practitioners have begun to work together on something called coordinated or comprehensive school health programs. This movement has broad international support from organizations like the World Health Organization, UNESCO, as well as support for government agencies like the Public Health Agency of Canada. The approach seeks to unite the resources of schools, public health agencies, and communities in establishing an environment that focuses on improving the health of children, broadly defined, to include mental and intellectual health, as well as physical and emotional health. The Joint Consortium for School Health is working in BC and across the province and across the provinces to institute these kinds of programs. The policies within coordinated school health programs focus on improving instruction through changes in curriculum, resources, and teaching, promoting preventative health services through screening, referrals, counseling, treatment, and coordination of services, increasing social supports through role modeling by school staff, peer support, public health policy, community participation, staff wellness, appropriate discipline policies, and extensive parental involvement, and creating a healthy physical environment focused on safety, sanitation, hygiene standards, healthy food services, and drug and smoke-free school policies. There's also research-based assessment tools that are available to support these kinds of changes. The Healthy School Report Card Canada from ASCD, and I'll throw out the caveat that I used to work for ASCD, so you should be aware of that when I mention the product. And Voices and Choices, which is a free resource available from Canada Public Health Agency. So these are assessment tools that you can use to help you guide the work on creating healthy environments within your schools. province needs to help schools and districts thus access these tools and allow them to focus on local context rather than narrow academic outcomes aggregated to provincial outcome goals. Provinces must resist the urge to create school health checklists that result in the same narrowing approach that is stimulated by standardized tests. Similarly, provinces must not try to hold schools accountable for healthy outcomes. Rather, they must support the self-assessment and then provide the resources that allow them to increase their capacity to change. Finally, taking a more economic approach, researchers, primarily in the U.S., have begun to conduct what's called costing out studies. These come at education reform from a resource angle. They look at the outcome goals that are defined by governments, so the standards that we've identified, and then ask what it should cost in money, resources, personnel, infrastructure, curriculum, etc., to build a system that will enable all of our students to achieve those goals. These studies estimate the level of finance associated with specific outcomes and the difference in cost for achieving the specific outcomes across children of different needs and in separate contexts. While the first cost studies occurred in the early 1980s and looked strictly at the resources necessary to provide adequate education, current studies, based on expanded methodologies, look at convening expert panels to estimate the resources required for each student to meet the desired standards and then aggregate, estimating the aggregate cost that that would require. There's also another model that uses an evidence-based matrix, which looks at what practices research has shown to be associated with improved learning and then estimate the cost of implementing those strategies. And by aggregating the cost of the district, site, and provincial levels, a more comprehensive analysis and dialogue of priorities and resource allocation can take place. Research based on these models, again, suggests that bringing children from high poverty or ELL backgrounds to proficiency may cost between 35 and 100% more than we're currently spending for students of their more affluent peers. These two, again, two of the many changes that focus on capacity building and school improvement. The challenge for BC educators and policymakers is to resist the easy solution offered by accountability and mandated accountability contracts that are based on a narrow range of outcomes, and instead to work toward a broad-based system that monitors the multiplicity of outcomes we desire in our schools and embraces a wide range of data. And the last thing that I'm going to add a comment on was I was really, really energized by the desire of the group to walk across the street right beforehand. I wish we had done that. I would have gladly ceded my 15 minutes or however long I've ended up taking to let us do that. I think it's really dangerous to support a strategy of disengagement. It's nice that we're all here talking, but we're talking amongst ourselves. It can be energizing. But we need to make sure that we do something with what we're doing here when we go home. Pulling back from the school planning councils, that is a podium from which we can talk if you want. And you can use it that way as a podium. So a strategy of disengagement focuses on the act of disengaging and not as much on the reasons behind which you're disengaging. So I would really encourage you to use the public podiums that you have to give your message to the two folks. Use the protection of tenure for what it was intended, to give you a voice. Thank you very much for your time.